This is The Resilient Life, where we believe that every human will struggle in this life. Our challenge is to struggle well. I'm Ryan Mannion. I lost my brother to war, my mom to cancer, and I'm the daughter of a retired Marine. I'm also a wife, mom, author, and president of one of the nation's leading veteran service organizations. Join me and some incredible guests as we explore the value of struggling well through life's inevitable challenges. Okay, welcome back to another episode of the Resilient Life Podcast. Today, I have guest Evan Slaughter joining us. And Evan, I have to tell you, I was in Miami last week and I was having dinner with my dad and he was asking me about some upcoming guests of the podcast. And I said, oh, and then I have this guy, Evan Slaughter. And he said, oh, who's he? And I showed him your Instagram page. And my dad's a retired colonel in the Marine Corps. And he was like, so, let me know a little bit more about this guy. And it was funny.
That's awesome.
If you knew my dad, it would be even funnier. but thanks for joining us here today. And I'll tell you, I started following you a little bit ago because you have hilarious content. So you're Fit to Serve One on Instagram, Fit to Serve on TikTok. I follow you on Instagram and, you know, I enjoy your content because I like comedy and humor and you have really funny content, but, coming onto the podcast, I obviously did my homework and kind of learned your backstory and there's just so much more to you. And, I'd love to kind of dive into a little bit of that today.
Yeah, for sure. I'm excited about it. Comedy has been the main thing, but I definitely try to share a little bit of my story just through opportunities like this. And then sometimes with some posts that are a little bit more deliberate about it. But definitely like to bring people in with comedy and then share a little bit more positive of a message through that.
Yeah. Well, so I'm kind of reading through your bio and there were a lot of similarities, I will say, in kind of especially when you talk about like growing up in high school and college and, you know, you partied a lot, you weren't super motivated, you know, C's get degrees, like, right. And I saw a lot of myself in you because that's really when I was in high school and college. Luckily, sports saved me. But I was very apathetic to my educational journey, I will say. And, you know, definitely, it was quite a contrast between me and then my brother, who was a straight A student, you know, all American wrestler and went to the Naval Academy. A lot of things that I envied about him, I think he also envied about me that I could just kind of not take things so seriously. But I saw a lot of kind of when you talked about that in your bio, I was like, I get that. I can really relate to where you were at that time.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned that about Travis, because I have an older brother that was the same way, like in band in high school and like straight A's and then went on to college and made great grades, met his current wife there freshman year, dated her the whole 4 years, four kids now, you know, and I was just not that way, you know. For me, it was a lack of motivation. I definitely did a lot of sports up until high school and then kind of just got out of it because I was just enjoying partying and meeting friends. And I was a very social person, always able to hang with any crowd, you know. And that's really kind of where I used a lot of comedy to fit into all these different crowds. This is why I was always just someone comfortable doing comedy stuff. But yeah, you know, tried the college thing, did 2 years at a school in Nashville, Lipscomb, and then went back to actually got put on academic probation for partying because it's a private Christian school. So it was that like it was wild. And so went back to UAB and did a little bit more time there and then finally just started like personal training and getting into fitness and stuff. And then that's when I decided to join the Army. So I was when I got to the Army, I felt like I'd found something that I could succeed at. You know, I love the structure about it. But yeah, high school and school settings were not my jam.
Well, let me ask you though, because a lot of people ask me, they're like, you know, you had this brother that was so driven, so disciplined. Did you have like, were you envious of that? And I'm like, no, I actually loved it because all the attention was on him, right? It was all about like what things Travis had going on, you know, and I was super proud of him. And so I didn't have that like competitive nature with him. It was all about like, yeah, that's my brother, you know, at a party on a Friday night with a keg of beer. Yeah. Oh yeah. You know, my brother. Yeah. He's pretty awesome. Right. How was it with you and your sibling?
So let me ask you, this was Travis older?
Travis was younger, but 15 months. So we were Irish twins, very close in age.
Yeah. Me and my brother are 18 months apart, but he was older. But it was the maturity levels were so, so vastly different. Yeah, it was a little bit, but I would say this, and he would for sure agree. Like in high school, he was definitely a band geek, you know? Okay. So, I mean, he was cool and everything, but he was just always in the band and then always making good grades. So he had his little, his circle of friends and stuff like that. But then I would say more so in college, he really found his groove. And then it's that typical story where it's like, you know, the jock who's now selling car insurance and then the band geek who's now, you know, super successful and owns all these businesses. That's him now. And so I think that whenever he got older and got into college, that's when I really started becoming kind of envious or real, like talking about him a lot more in a way where I would tell these stories about Owen and what he's doing and all, you know, because he is super successful. And so it was kind of like that, I guess, for me with him after we finished school.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you kind of jumped forward, you know, you left college.
Yeah.
You became a personal trainer. But at the time you're a personal trainer, you also get hooked on OxyContins.
Yeah, that's right.
I read that you're training clients and then you're heading out into the parking lot to snort some Oxy before the next one.
Or the laundry room at the gym, whatever environment. No. Well, yeah, that's how it was. That's how it was.
And it's crazy because I had a guy on my show, Zach Clark, not too long ago. And Zach was actually, he won the Bachelor. So, you know, I mean, like the height of fame for those that watch The Bachelor, right? But his thing was that he actually was addicted to crack. And prior, you know, he was clean by the time he went on the show, but he told the story. He came from a very affluent family, right around in the Philadelphia area where I'm from. And he was working for his dad who owned like this, you know, very successful financial services company. And he said, you know, he would work with clients. And then when everybody would go home, he'd sit in his office and pull out a crack pipe, you know? And so I read that quote from you and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you know, it's this idea of, you know, how people can see you on one side. You know, no one's going to attribute a personal trainer with someone that is addicted to narcotics, right? And, and you know, this idea that how you get off of them is, I mean, that's not just something where you make the decision one day to say, I'm stopping, right? There has to be medical intervention. And you ended up in treatment, which you ended up telling your parents, right? That you were addicted.
Yeah. The first time. So in high, like when I was doing that in college age, doing the personal training stuff, it did get to a point where because there was addiction in my family, my dad actually went through his deal when I was about 15, 16 and ended up going to rehab and getting sober. I felt a little bit more comfortable about, you know, approaching him. So I called him one day when I was doing it because it was, I knew it was not good. I knew it was bad. And I knew it was, like you were saying, something that I couldn't stop, especially with opiates, like because you get so physically sick, that's a lot of times what keeps you going, you know, outside of the mental part of it. It's just like, I don't want to be physically sick from this. I've got to go to work the next day. I got to do all this stuff. So I knew I needed help and was able to call him up. And that same day, I went to a little 30-day program and got out and was doing fine. And shortly after that, I joined the Army.
And so while you're in that program, you actually are going through that program with veterans that are going through the program. And that
You did do your research. This is impressive.
Come on now.
I sure did. Yeah. And looking back on it now, it's like it was meant to be, right? Because they definitely, you know, if you have good health insurance, which I did at the time, You either stay for the 14 days or you stay for the 30 days. So my insurance would cover the 30 days. So they moved me to up to the 30 day house. And that happened to be the house that active duty military were in.
Wow.
So anyone that was stationed near Alabama, I think a lot of them were from Louisiana. But they were active duty military and they were there for various things and 30 day deal. So I was in the house with a bunch of active duty military guys and got to learn all about it there.
And so you get out and you join the Army because you said the wait list to join the Marines was too long.
Yeah. So I had no idea like about joining the military, you know, other than just talking to people, but
you
still
have background in your family at all?
I've got two grandfathers that were both served,
okay.
But it was a different time then for
sure.
Then, you know, I think one was even drafted. So it was, so I go just decide I want to join, go to the Marine Corps first, right? I had a friend that was in the Marines and go down there and I have to fill out all this stuff. I had to get references. And mind you, we're also like starting really moving into Afghanistan at this time. This was 2010.
Okay, 2010. Got it.
Yeah. So I was thinking in my mind that I walk in, sign up, you know, they're grateful to have someone like me who's got some college and, you know, whatever. And we get on a bus later that afternoon or tomorrow and go to the, you know, join the Marines. And that is not how it was at all. So yeah, they hit me with the, yeah. And so in about 9 months, you'll leave for boot camp. And I was like, 9 months, damn, I don't even know if I want to do this in 9 months, you know?
Right.
So
right.
I like shortly after that went over to the Army recruiter office and kind of the same thing, but only 3 months. And it was real easy. I knew I wanted to combat MOS, you know, join infantry, 11 Bravo. And so there wasn't a lot of decision making. Like I went in there knowing I wanted to be in the infantry. So that was easy. And yeah, so 3 months, it was 3 month deal. And I left, I think January 2010. So this was 2009, looking to sign up, left January 2010, something like that, either 2010 or 2011, something.
And so you get there and 3 months after joining the Army, you're deploying to Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, well, so, you know, infantry was 14 weeks. It's the only MOS, military occupation specialty job, otherwise known, that you go to basic and then you do the AIT, which is, you know, the advanced training for that job in the same spot.
Okay.
But normally you join the Army and you go to basic, you finish basic, you get a little bit of leave, and then you go to wherever, if you're going to be a truck driver or a commo person or whatever, then you go to that specialty training. But infantry is just 14 weeks straight through at Fort Benning. And so I did that. And while I was in there, I mean, I was really fit, doing really good, excelled. And I picked up an opportunity to go to Special Forces selection right after I finished infantry. So I went to airborne school at Fort Benning because that's required to move on to the selection process. And then I went up to Fort Bragg right after that for SOPC and selection. So I was basically, you know, I don't know the exact time, but it was more than 3 months. And so after that, I ended up at a long range surveillance unit in Texas. We get there and then we deploy as soon as I get there, pretty much.
So what did your parents think when you told them that? I mean, again, I'm thinking from the lens of being a parent. I know my child struggled with addiction. They've just gone through rehab. And then they're like, I want to go into the military. Like, did your parents think that was a good idea? Did they have reservations?
You know, I think they were obviously concerned at being, you know, joining during a wartime, you know. So it was like,
well, there's
he's
that
getting
too.
Deployed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think they were more worried about that. But then it was one of those scenarios where once I was in and they saw me graduate and they saw me excelling and everything, they were very proud of it.
Yeah.
So it just, I think with any parent, kind of like you're saying, it's definitely got to be nerve wracking. I'm not a parent, so I don't know what that's like, but I can imagine that it's probably pretty nerve wracking. And then just being gone and not being home and you're not being able to see them as much and stuff like that, but definitely turned into something they were super proud of.
Yeah. So you're in Afghanistan and lead gunner on a patrol. You guys are hit by an IED. Your tendon in your ankle gets messed up, but you're still able to stay for the rest of that deployment. You receive a Purple Heart from it and you come back. And this is something that I thought was so interesting. You come back and obviously you start taking medication, opioids again, for your pain management. Did that get prescribed to you by a doctor?
Yeah. So I went through the military, you know, it was almost like, especially at the time I was in, and I don't know if it's different now, but it's like, it's almost like, okay, the military, or at least the army, looks at it like this, like, okay, this happened, so we have to treat him this way, because they're very, right, you know, have protocol for everything. They've got a handbook for everything, you know? And so I felt like it was kind of along the lines of that. So like, you're injured overseas, this is the treatment that we're going to subscribe, you know, prescribe you. And then you kind of go on from there. So I actually was, you know, treated within the military base and then referred out to a civilian pain management deal.
Now, did your prior addiction ever come up?
No. And I think that's really on me, you know, because I definitely could have said something, and I don't know if that would have changed the course of action or not, but I was also in a place where I was years removed from the last time I had issues with it. And at the same time, I think in my mind was kind of thinking that I could handle it. And two, I was justified for doing it. Whereas before, I was just doing it recreationally. I was much younger, and now I was injured, and right, I did need to do something. Now, I mean, the acetaminophen probably could have done the same thing for me, looking back on it, especially after it had been some time since the injury happened. So I just didn't say anything about it.
Yeah, because I thought about that, and I'm like, you know, that's kind of wild. And sure, you could say, yeah, I probably should have said something. But in the mind of an addict too, right? Like, you're in your head going, oh, it's been years, I used it recreationally, I can just take these now because I need them, right? I have actual pain that needs to be treated. And so, you know, I look at like kind of the healthcare space, like that should always be a question when you're prescribing narcotics to someone, right? Have you ever had an issue with narcotics in the past? Certainly you could have lied about that, but I feel like that should be something where we are in today's society with the rampant addiction and opioid crisis. Like, we should be asking everyone we're prescribing opioids to if they've had issues. And not only that, you have documented rehab from the opioids. Like, it wasn't like, yeah, I kind of had a problem. Like, no, you actually went to rehab to overcome it. So I thought about that. Well, you know, and unfortunately, you end up back addicted to opioids as a result of it, you know?
That's right, yeah.
And talk me through, because again, you come back, you're injured, you're honorably discharged, you're a Purple Heart recipient, so you've accomplished something, right? Like, you have that time in service, that you were purposeful, that you were part of this team, that you were doing something, and now you're back and you're kind of in the same place from where you started. Like, what addiction was, or what like part of your life was harder, that first time after college or this time, you know?
Yeah, no, so it definitely was the second time around. And I mean, like, a lot of it was that justification. And two, I had this mentality about me that's kind of, you know, like almost that, because there was someone, you know, one of our guys in our unit killed in that same incident I was in. And, you know, he hit an IED before us, and we hit a secondary IED going out to provide some help for that situation. And so I just had this mentality too, that I'd done enough, you know, like you said, like Purple Heart recipient, all this stuff in my mid-20s, coming back. And I was just kind of cocky about it a little bit, I think, and just kind of no purpose at the time. Like, getting out of the military definitely took some, I didn't know what I was going to do. I went from being in a environment where you're told what time to be where, what to wear, what to, you know. And I thrived, I think, in that environment. And now I'm getting back, you know, getting out, hooked on opiates. I've got no health insurance now because you lose your TRICARE as an active duty member. So I got out, and there's a big time gap. I think I didn't get treatments from the VA till 14 months after I got out of the Army. So I get out, start seeing a civilian doctor again for medication, and it just takes right off. And I'm like abusing the crap out of it, obviously. And it just took me down a spot where, like, that was my life every day, you know. It's like, take these opiates, and it was just kind of covering up me dealing with anything else, you know. So it definitely got way worse the second time, and struggled on and off for several years until finally getting back in a place where I could get help again.
Did your family the second time around know that you were going through this again?
Yeah, it became very obvious after a while. You know, I had had issues. I actually got in trouble legally, you know, so was arrested for something, you know, related around it. Was actually trying to prescribe myself medication over the phone, which is not something I would recommend to anyone. But so, you know, I got in trouble and went through the veteran court program. And that's what led to me kind of getting sober for a little while. So I'd like get sober for a year and then kind of come back to it. And then the last time when it came back to it, it just gotten so bad where it's like, you know, it was definitely obvious, and it led to friends and family like reaching out to help me, kind of intervention style.
Yeah, well, I think too, you know, maybe a blessing and a curse, but like you trying to prescribe, you know, impersonate a doctor on the phone.
Yeah.
And I love that. So you actually, you call around to enough pharmacies that you get flagged.
Yeah.
And then,
exactly.
And then the one pharmacy says, oh yeah, sure, come pick up your prescription. But it was basically like a sting operation.
I'm like, sweet, it worked.
Yeah. And you get in there and then they arrest you.
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah. And
as soon as I purchase it,
yeah,
they arrest.
But you know, you needed that. It was almost that rock bottom moment, right? That you
had you
needed, you know, that needed to happen.
Yeah, for sure. It totally saved my life at the time. And it was so, you know, where I was arrested at, you know, the DA of that county was a close family friend and knew my situation, knew what was going on with my military past and all that kind of stuff, knew I'd been injured in combat and was really able to provide the treatment I needed. I was actually treated, I would say, a little bit more harshly in that court program. Like, they were quick to stay on top of me, make sure I was getting the help I needed, make sure I was doing the things they assigned me to do. They were drug testing me like basically 4 or 5 times a week.
Wow.
And then it turned into every day. Every day I would have to drive 30 minutes both ways to go do this drug test. So I was at the time a little bit pissed off about it and thought I was being treated unfairly. But looking back on it now, you know, it was like, well, it totally saved my life, because the opiates out there today will kill you. You know, with the stuff out there now, you can do something that you think you're doing one thing and then it's got fentanyl or whatever in it and you die from it, you know? So I'm definitely grateful at this moment in my life, looking back at all that, that it happened that way.
How did you feel about the Veterans Treatment Court? Because I know that, you know, my county, there's a big push for it. It's happening, but you know, you see things all around. And as somebody who went through that process, do you think it's something that we need to continue advocating for across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. And the county that I was in at the time, it was Shelby County in Alabama. They were the first county to start the Veterans Court program in the state of Alabama. Mm. So they were like the model for how to do it. So they were very, you know, they had the attorney that was in charge of the veteran court program there that assisted the judge. I think it was assistant DA at the time. Marine Corps veteran, like still Marine Reserves. He'd go to reserve weekend. So he knew what he was doing. The judge was not a veteran, but had people supporting him so much that were veterans, like the assistant DA. So it was good because they had a VA advocate that would come in and make sure that you're getting the treatments that you needed from the VA and helping you get signed up for your disability if you didn't have that, you know? And so it was definitely something that, now, you know, the punishments were harsh. I mean, they would lock you up if you failed a drug test for like a couple weeks, you know, so it was kind of motivation to not fail drug tests. But they could also assist you in getting treatment if you needed treatment and having it paid for, and you didn't have to pay for your drug test and all your dues were covered outside of your fine to be in the thing. But so I think it's something wonderful that every state should have.
That's awesome. So after that, you kind of get into some real estate, you're doing that, and you're having some success, but you're lacking that purpose, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's hard to go into an office environment, and I just didn't thrive in an office environment. I mean, I was successful at what I was doing, but I was unhappy. And not just, I think, coming from the military and, you know, deployment and being an infantry unit, long range surveillance, all that stuff. doing all this cool guy crap, you know, and then go into this office. I think just that's just my personality anyways. Like, I would rather be outside with a shovel, you know, working blue collar jobs on a construction site than being in an office like that. So I did it for a little while. And like I said, was good at it, but just wasn't happy. And then got offered a position with a plumbing company to be the operations manager. And that was even more office time because they were open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I was the dude that had to answer the phone and set up the calls and, you know, dispatch plumbers to different jobs. And it was even more office work. So I just was struggling, you know, no purpose, not happy with what I was doing for sure.
I love this. You did there was a quote that we pulled from a podcast that you're recently on. And you said, a lot of times it seems like veterans like the chaos of things. And when that chaos is removed, you know, no more deployments, army life, sometimes you look to create your own chaos. And that's what I was doing in my life. But now I'm doing it in a positive way. And one of my good friends, was an Army Ranger, and he's on his way out of a very difficult 18 months, and which involved treatment programs and all sorts of different things. And he's talked to me about chaos and how he thrives in chaos. And he came home as a new father, and he's at home. He's 100% disabled. Or disability rating. And he's at home, like sitting around playing with his daughter, you know, while his wife's working. And it was like that lack of chaos made him go crazy. It literally put him over the edge. And he was like finding opportunities to participate in some dangerous chaos, I will say. You know, and so that like shift from what, and he did seven deployments, you know, in like 6 years. I mean, he did a lot of crazy stuff. And so how you come back from that and just go back into this civilian world, which in a lot of ways we try to design it to not be chaotic, right? Like, how can we offer something that is not chaotic to you? And a lot of veterans end up failing because they don't have that fast pace, especially, combat veterans that have been in some really high stress situations. So I related to that so much just from the perspective of my friend who, you know, I'm watching now deal with the chaos in a positive way and create positive situations for chaos. So I see that. But you're doing this and then you get this. Let's talk about how you shift from, you know, administrative work for a plumber, real estate to TikTok fame, we'll call it. Like, where's the idea that, like, you know, I'm going to make a reel on TikTok and see where it goes?
Yeah. So, you know, it was what I was doing at the time, like when I got out of the plumbing thing and I sold some real estate I had owned, that's what made it really easier for me to pursue that because I had enough money to where I could say, all right, I could look at it on paper and go, I don't need to go get a job right away. I've got some time here where I can try to really do something I enjoy. And I was messing around on TikTok a little bit while working, but knowing what I know now about it and doing it full time for almost 2 years now, I realize how difficult that is. So people that try to do it while they're working, it's just so much harder. So I was fortunate in that aspect where I could really pour into this. And so I enjoyed comedy stuff. I enjoyed making people laugh. I enjoyed being creative in that space and trying to take stuff and I would watch things and then try to do it in my own way that, you know, was original and authentic to me. And I started having some success on there. And once I remember, you know, the first video that I got on TikTok that almost hit 1 million views, I was like, okay, you know, that's all it took for me. I was like, one time, I was like, people like what I was putting out. They at least like this, you know, so let me continue to do this. And I got more and more into the sketch comedy side of things. And then it just translated over into Instagram. And I remember getting paid the first time at the end of middle of 2022, I think is the first time, towards the end of 2022, the first time someone offered me money to make the reels for the, you know. And I was like, this is a real thing. And I was like, as long as I can keep doing this and it grows to where I don't have to go get another job, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And now it's turned into, the best thing I've ever done and the most money I've ever made. And and it's something I look forward to getting up and doing every day.
Well, it's wild too, because this whole idea of like TikTok creators, there are an exorbitant amount of people that make their living off of TikTok.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's funny. I've never posted on TikTok, but I like watching TikToks, I'll say. And I'll see people, I forget this woman that I follow. Her mom was on Real Housewives of New Jersey, Lauren.
Okay.
Lauren Manzo. And so she talks about, like, she's a TikTok creator, and she's like, so I'm just gonna keep talking for the, and she does a lot of like mukbangs or whatever you call them, and but people follow her, and she's like, and I've got 10 seconds that I have to continue talking to get to a minute so I can get paid for this video. Like, she like walks you through what she has to do to get paid. She's like, and this video is not going to be a minute. I don't care if I don't get paid, but I'm going to tell you this real quick. But you're making a living off of creating viral reels for people to watch. And it's very foreign to people that aren't in social media and don't understand social media. That you can actually, and you hear all these stories, like your story is not unique to, I'm making more money than I ever did, on TikTok. So the big looming question, and then we'll kind of get back to it, is like, obviously you have to be tracking in a big way what's happening down in Congress about TikTok potentially being banned. Like, do you have that? Okay. What's the backup plan? Because I feel like if that goes through, it's going to be like lights out real quick.
Yeah, I think it will be for a lot of people. So for me, I started on TikTok and then Instagram took off. And I actually have a larger following now on Instagram than I do on TikTok.
Okay.
And the money you get from views on TikTok, it's good. It's the best on any other platform out there, but it's not. For me, at least, it's not like my bread and butter, right?
Okay.
So like when it took off on Instagram for me, that's when companies started approaching about me. And for me, it's marketing deals, finding a unique way to take a product and incorporate it into a comedy reel that people will watch. And that's the value I bring to these companies. So I get a lot of eyes on their company or their product. And so that's where I've really found success. So now at this time, where I'm at, it's almost like because I was deliberate about trying to grow both platforms, that's kind of like the goal, right? And most creators on TikTok will tell you they really try to grow their Instagram because of all the stuff that TikTok is flaky, and the advertising in terms of the market world isn't the best. Most US-based companies, at least, want to advertise on Instagram. So for me at this point, I'm actually fine with that. If they do ban it, it's only going to help my Instagram out because it's going to bring the 167,000 people on TikTok that follow my stuff that aren't following me on Instagram. Some of them may, but not most of them. Usually if they do one, they don't do the other as much. So, I'm kind of good with it and kind of like fingers crossed, like maybe it will happen. Now, I hate it, though, because I have friends on there who have huge accounts, One guy that's like 9 million followers on TikTok, and he's got a decent Instagram following, but that would be a situation where, he's really advocating for it to not shut down, which I understand.
Well, I think it's interesting from any platform. So Instagram, I have friends that, their business is through Instagram, right? That's how they, and you think like if Instagram, like let's say Instagram, when like you're almost, your business relies on you're like a contracted employee almost for these social media companies that could go dark tomorrow. And then what is, and I see a lot of people trying to start things and it doesn't really work, but trying to start platforms on their own so that they don't miss that audience. And I have people all the time, like, follow me on here, where I'm going to be putting out Substacks through my website. And that's where you can get my content. But it's it's not easy, right? It's much easier to go on to, but you think about kind of the implications if all of it went down, if all of the social media platforms went down, like what, and I saw the TikTok CEO talking and he said, it was like crazy, the amount of, it was like 300, don't quote me on this. It was 300 billion in like revenue to employees. It was something wild. Golly.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
Go away. And you know, and it, and listen, I'm not for the Chinese spying on us by any means. That's happening. Take it. So I get some of that, but it's just kind of wild to see, you know, how we are so dependent upon these platforms to actually, and listen, we do it at the Travis Manning Foundation. Like we rely on social media. It's our best marketing tool, right?
Right.
To talk about the work that we're doing. And
It is for so many companies. That's the thing. That's especially Instagram. That's why they do it. It's more affordable. It's modern day TV commercials. You know, it's like, that's where a lot of these companies are putting their marketing dollars, you know?
And they should. I mean, we used to talk about back in the day, like direct mail campaigns and, okay, what do we need to do to make enough money that we could actually take some of that and put it towards advertising via commercials? And, you know, it's like $100 million you need to run like a robust and meaningful commercial through, you know, that people actually see, because they've got to see it more than one time. It has to be like ingrained in them. And we put a heavy emphasis on digital marketing. And last year we saw some incredible growth with our athletic events through digital marketing. And these are people that don't follow us on TMF, don't know anything about us. It's not like an influencer like you talking about, hey, sign up for something with TMF. This is literally an ad as they're scrolling and they look at it and they think it's cool and they want to participate in it and they sign up. And so, you know, you look at all of this and it's just, but you're kind of beholden to the maker of these platforms, which is, it's just a wild thing when I think about it more.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think that's why as a creator, I always have a game plan for what's next, you know, like, in my mind, I can't do, you know, influencer marketing forever. I think there's a time where I won't have the same effect for the company that I will, which I totally understand. And I just think that comes with growing older and, you know, all these different things. Now, that doesn't mean that I can't be successful at it, that there's not a direction I could go that, you know, I could still keep that going, but it's like, I'm always looking at what's next. You know, is it grow the YouTube side of things? Is it start a podcast? So I think that's the best way. You got to stay fluid in this, you know, industry for sure. And always be thinking ahead in case this stuff happens, you know?
Have you thought about any interest in the stand-up route, doing stand-up?
I get that all the time. And I have, yes, I do. And I'm actually writing some stuff. And I want to find the right medium to go and attempt it for the first time. And so I think that will happen for sure. And I do have a game plan to do some of that. So hopefully that will come.
Yeah. I mean, you're in Nashville. I mean, you've got a good area of concentration where you could get up on a stage somewhere, right? And test those waters.
Totally. Theo Vaughn lives here. There's a Zany's Nashville branch here. Shane Gillis comes to a lot. The thing about it is you hear a lot of these stories from most of these comedians that are doing stand-up now. It's a grind. Okay. Like, they're doing these open mic things, you know, for years until they finally get to where they can. But I think it's becoming a little bit different because so many people are putting, big names are putting stuff out on YouTube. And they're creating these shows on YouTube that are just on YouTube. Like Shane Gillis' special, I think, is on YouTube. So it's like, maybe that's the route, you know, shoot something on YouTube and do it that way.
I saw, I don't know if you follow like any of the Barstool podcasts, but the BFFs podcast and then Plan Bree with Brianna and O'Malley. So O'Malley's, they're like best friends and she's got red hair. She's just been doing this podcast with Brianna and they had Whitney Cummings on, and Whitney Cummings talking to this girl O'Malley about, because she's a comedian and she's super funny, but I've only seen her on podcasts, right? On this podcast. And Whitney Cummings, and she's talking about how she wants to do stand up. And Whitney Cummings says, well, why don't you join me on tour? And she's now opening up for her on her next tour. And Dave Portnoy is like, I'm watching the next episode. He's like, is this for real? And he's holding up like the thing where it says like O'Malley opening up for Whitney Cummings. And it's like, yeah, she's opening up for her. And he's like, this is wild. Like, does she do stand up, you know? And she's going to do it now, you know, she just got a big opportunity. So maybe that's it. Maybe you need to just talk to like Shane or Theo Vaughn and say,
get on Theo's and he just invites me to open. Yeah.
An opening act. That'd be
the opportunity you can't say no to for sure.
Well, I think it's good though, that you're thinking about that plan B, like what's the backup plan. And you know, one of the things, so if you don't follow Evan and you haven't followed any of, you know, you're very self-deprecating about, you know, it's a lot of you with no shirt on and your belly, which has gotten significantly smaller because you've lost 60 pounds, which is amazing. Yeah. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And CrossFit played a big role in that for you.
CrossFit played a huge role. Yeah. And so like what I started doing was just doing sketch comedy stuff around things that I was involved in myself. So maybe it's, you know, pickleball was a big one. And then I was trying to get back in shape. And so I started doing this, your friend that just started running or your friend that just started CrossFit. And so it was things that I was really interested in and starting to do. And so I found that through like being purposeful about, this out of shape dude, I'm going to take my shirt off. I'm going to be me. I got so much positive reaction from that, from the community, people that were struggling getting back to the gym, people that were, you know, all these messages coming in. And so that's where it became more purposeful for me about doing this. Like, okay, this is funny and people love it and they're sharing it and they're laughing about it. But there's also a community that's really getting something out of this. It's helping them. And so as I found that out, I really dove more into that. And then CrossFit has become something that, outside of losing the weight. And I'm also doing, I started with this deal Blokes that helps, had my blood tested, found out my testosterone levels, all these different things. And then got on some stuff that was helping me to get optimized, which really kickstarted the weight loss, which has only helped me to be more active in the gym and more regular with it. Mm-hmm. So all of it just kind of playing together and has kind of just really fueled that motivation for me for sure.
Yeah. I love that. And I think, you know, to the average person, CrossFit can be super intimidating. Yeah. I think actually, if you follow CrossFit, like I follow CrossFit on Instagram, and if you follow them, they will show every different type of person participating in CrossFit. They'll show an 80-year-old man. They'll show a 8-year-old girl, you know, but just this whole idea of CrossFit is, you know, it has this stigma attached to it that it's intimidating and it's these super hard, intense workouts, which they are, but they can all be scaled to your ability level. And it's something that we have to constantly put in and overcome for our Mannion Wad. So our Mannion Wad is a CrossFit workout. It's, you know, accredited by CrossFit. It's actually one of the first hero wads that was put out by CrossFit. And it's ridiculous when you look at it prescribed, you know, for a guy, it's 135 pounds, 29 back squats at 135 pounds, and then a 400 meter run 7 times.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and for a woman, it's 95 pounds. And I have never done it at the prescribed weight. I was trying to squat yesterday with my daughter and we got it, you know, I was squatting at 100 pounds. I did like 10 squats total. You know, I couldn't do 200 and something squats, but you know, I can partner up. I can do it with a sandbag. I can do air squats. And so we're always trying to like, because people are like, I want to be in the Mannion Wad, but it's too much for me. I'm like, no, you can do it. I promise.
Yeah. Just do it. Yeah. Just try it. I mean, that was the deal with the open workout they just did. And if you, to your point, you know, obviously Dave Castro, former Navy SEAL, right? He helps a lot with the military side of things, but there is a big military audience there anyways. I don't know if you've heard of the organization Valor Fit. They like try to raise money for veterans to get gym memberships. Like they pay for their gym membership. So it's this idea of like
That's cool.
getting them off the couch and getting them so that way when they do get out, they've got no excuse to not go. And I think they do some other stuff, but they had the guy, I think who started it, and I'm blanking on his name right now. I met him at the Open. They did it live here in Nashville. So they live stream it when they announce the workout. Actually, Jocko did the announcement remote. So they like sent it over to Jocko to do the actual workout. But before the elite athletes did the workout live, they did just three other people. One was a gym member at the gym they announced it at. And then they had the guy from Valor Fit who's about as in good a shape as I am, right? So he takes his shirt off and he does, like, I was like, man, kudos to you, dude, because obviously he couldn't do what was prescribed either. But it's just, and I did the workout and couldn't do it even close to prescribed. But it's just those steps of going through it and then maybe giving you something to work towards. Like maybe my goal is to do as much as I can of it prescribed next time or something. I think that's what's cool. But it also gives you a crazy appreciation for the elite athletes that do for a living that are doing it prescribed, you know, because you're like, God, this smoked me. And to watch them go through it and, you know, is incredible.
Well, the first time I did the Mannion Wad, I did it at the Naval Academy. The Naval Academy has a CrossFit gym on campus. So I did it with a bunch of midshipmen who were in like peak condition, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, I was blown away. I couldn't walk for 2 days afterwards. And I was doing it with like a 15-pound bar, you know, and I'm watching them just like, you know, they did it and they probably went out and ran 5 miles the next day. And I totally get you. Yeah. You just have this such a deeper appreciation for the work that goes into the elite athletes at CrossFit, but it's also a very welcoming community. You know, no one's turning their nose up at you because you're not at that level, you know? And it's always about like, what's the best that you can do, right? And how do you work towards improving upon that as you go forward? So.
Yeah, no, totally. I was welcomed in better than I expected. I mean, the community, and I do a lot for CrossFit. I do a lot of marketing with a lot of products, RX Markier jump ropes, all these big names. Ice Barrel is another big sponsor of mine. And so at first I didn't expect that, you know, I was thinking you see all these elite athletes at the CrossFit games and stuff. There's no way that they would want to do anything with me, you know, but then CrossFit Games collabed on one of my videos recently and then posted me on their story and stuff. And it is like that. And the first time I walked into a gym, I was super intimidated, but you also realize that there's a ton of people there that aren't in great shape. Like most of the people aren't doing the workouts as prescribed as you go into it. You know, that's a smaller percentage. So it's just taking, and I talk a lot about that, it's taking the initial step, being bold enough and vulnerable enough to just take that step to go in there.
Yeah.
Because I was comfortable in a gym environment. I went through special forces selection. You know, I went through all these different things. And, but getting out of shape and then trying to go back into the gym is super intimidating.
Yeah. And I think that's it. It's much harder to take that first step than to actually be in there doing it, you know?
Absolutely. Just to get in absolutely.
There. So Ice Barrel, you said, is a sponsor of yours. So where are you in your ice bath journey? Are you an everyday ice bather? You know, there's this whole like kind of cultist community of the ice bath.
I love it. Have you done it much?
I have. I've got a 100-gallon Rubbermaid tub up on my deck. And nice. Yeah, so I'm not.
I don't do it every day, but I definitely do it regularly. Did one. And I'm pretty deliberate. I mean, I have a friend that gets up every morning at, you know, before work, 7 a.m., no matter what the temperature is outside, no matter what, he's in that thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not me by any means, but I do it several times a week and then especially use it as recovery from an exercise.
Yeah.
So I love a good workout and then getting in the barrel and using that as a recovery tool because of how it, you know, I can be tired from the workout, whatever, and then get in that water and come out and feel like $1 million. So
my husband actually does the ice bath and then works out. And he's
heard of that too, for sure.
And he has some of like the greatest workouts. If he does it pre-workout, he'll do the ice bath and then go work out. So, but I'm always interested, you know, now you see all like now, of course, because the community's come so big about the benefits of, and again, it's relatively cheap. If you want to just go the way I did and buy a big Rubbermaid tub, you fill it up with water. And right now in the Northeast, I don't have to do anything else. It's 35 degrees, you know, but, or you can, you know, buy the cream of the crop, but now you kind of see the Western medicine side of things starting to like, talk about the dangers of ice baths and oh, be careful. And I just think it's so funny. I'm like, how about if it works for you, let it work. Because clearly people are seeing benefits to it, you know, and you don't have to like dispel it because it's not another prescription that you're, you know, shoving down people's throats. Like sometimes it is simply just like getting sunlight, exercising, you know, cold plunges, like it works, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So the biggest thing for me too, that because obviously it's not meant for, you see people staying in it way too long and they'll do these challenges where they're trying to be in this cold water for way too long. And like really the prescribed time frame is, you know, 3 to 5 minutes at the most. Sometimes people do 2 minutes, three. It doesn't take much. The biggest benefit for me has been, and you know, it got popular from the Wim Hof, you know, method and how he was using cold water to deal with his anxiety from losing his wife who killed herself and left him with his two kids, you know? And he said, whenever I was in that cold water, anything that I was thinking about with her and what was going on, that went away because I was forced to be focusing and present on where I was at with this water.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the mindset I've taken into it. You know, there's even meditations that people are doing now where the Ice Barrel is coming out with an app where that you can play a recorded meditation for that three times and it gives you something to focus on while you're doing it in the, so like set an intention and then get in the water. So for me, it's been a huge tool that I've used for mental health because one, I hate getting in the cold water, right? So every time that I do it and force myself to get into it, it's like I'm winning a little goal there. You know, I'm overcoming something. I'm overcoming a fear, right? And so that's just helping me grow so much mentally outside of the physical benefits.
Oh, yeah. I think there's a huge mental component to it. I feel the same way. Like I could probably not do anything else, but if I took a cold plunge that day, I'm like, I cold plunge. Like I
won the
day.
That's right.
You know?
That's
and they right. actually said, if you read the scientific research behind it, 11 minutes a week is the optimal number. So it doesn't have to be, you know, these long drawn out things, like go in for a couple minutes, hop out.
That's right.
All right. So going back to the CrossFit, you know, I talked a little bit about Manion Wad. I'm wondering if you are going to be participating in the Manion Wad this year, now that you're a CrossFit enthusiast.
Absolutely, I am. I'm looking forward to it. Now, I don't, you know, I can squat, but I don't know about 135 pounds for the whole thing. So I probably will scale it. But that style workout for the Manion Wad is the type I like better, where it's not a ton of different movements, all that kind of stuff. And it's got an end goal, right? I know I have to do it 7 times. So I'm looking forward to it big time.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. We, you know, every year that I do it with a large group of people. And again, there's some people killing it at the prescribed weight. And then there are some people that are splitting it up and only doing air squats and, you know, and partnering up with someone. But no matter what, if you push yourself, right, you're going to walk away from that with the same thing as like getting in that cold plunge. Like you're going to feel super accomplished. And it is a leg game. So you'll have some burning quads for a few days, but I feel like I think back to the first time that I did that and I was in so much pain that I was physically unable to get up from the couch the next day. Like,
see, that's what I'm not looking forward to.
And here's the thing, like where I am today, like I can see the progression over the years to where I am today. And so it is about like, and that's what I love about CrossFit is like, you can track your progression, right? You can track and see how far you've come and where you started. So
that's right. Yeah.
It's good stuff. Cool. Well, good. I'm excited to see how you feel about your first Manion Wad.
I'll be posting about it for sure.
Awesome. All right. Well, Evan, this was great. I'd like to, you know, end on the question I ask everybody at the end. And that is, what does living a resilient life look like for you?
Gosh, that's something I'm super, I talk a lot about because to me, it just means not giving up, right? Like, I used to beat myself up so bad for mistakes I would make, especially in the addiction aspect of things. And I think a lot of people do, which is why a lot of people sadly end up not making it through it. You know, they either overdose or they end up taking their own life. And so for me, it's learning to forgive myself, but then how am I going to, what change am I going to make so I don't go down that pathway again? And so I think looking back on things, that's what living a resilient life means to me, right? Like I still make mistakes today, you know, and obviously, like, just from what I've done and been able to overcome with a lot of help and a lot of motivation, it doesn't mean that I'm not still having areas in my life that I need to improve, but it's forgiving myself and then making a change in order to prevent that from happening again.
Yeah, totally. I love it. You've got an awesome story. I love how much you've overcome and how you're using humor to be the modality that helps you move forward. It's good stuff. Thanks for all you do. And, you know, thanks for, I'll be looking for that Mannion Wad, see how you're doing. Thanks for supporting the Travis Mannion Foundation through that way. And again,
absolutely.
Thanks for joining this community to share your story.
I appreciate you giving me the platform to do it on.